Homicide rates are hard to talk about for a lot of reasons. First of all, any number of homicides is too many homicides. Plus, if you know a victim personally, it is hardly the numbers that matter. That said, 2018 did see what looks like, dare I say, good news if you're going by the numbers. Homicides were down in Kansas City, and dramatic improvements in Kansas City's northeast suggest that a new approach in that part of town might provide a template for the rest of the city to follow. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And we'll start today's show by digging into the numbers, and then we'll get past statistics, asking our expert panel what doesn't get talked about enough when it comes to homicide. Chris Haxel is a Guns in America reporter here at KCUR, and he's going to start by telling us what the numbers mean and what they don't mean. Hi, Chris.
Good morning.
The numbers show homicide slightly down from 2018, right?
The total for 2018 was 135 homicides in the city of Kansas City. That's down from 151 in 2017.
And then the greater metro numbers are a little different.
I believe the overall metro number was around 200, which also represents a slight decrease.
So how big of a difference do you consider 2018 when you look at the trends leading up to 2018?
They were down about 10% in the city of Kansas City, which is, full stop, good news. However, that also mirrors trends we're seeing across the country in big cities, so it's not clear whether that is unique to Kansas City. And that also comes on the tail of a few years now of an elevated homicide rate. And despite that decrease, we're still kind of in that elevated level.
So I am correct in remembering that the homicide rate had spiked over the past few years, and you're saying we're still at that elevated level. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, so for maybe the past 10 years or so, Kansas City averaged somewhere in the neighborhood of 100, 110 homicides per year. In 2014, it dropped significantly down to 82. But then after that, it dropped back. Jumped back up to kind of your typical numbers in 2015, but now 16, 17, and 18, we saw 130, 150, 135.
Yeah. This drop in the homicide rate is part of a national trend, and you have mentioned that. Can you explain a little more about that? You're part of a national reporting project, and just in your conversations with your colleagues, what are some thoughts about why that might be?
Well, the short answer is nobody knows. As unfortunate as that response is, when you look at national trends year to year, really what you're talking about is, hundreds of cities across the country that are driving these numbers. So in a city like Chicago, which is kind of known as the outlier, well, homicides down about 15% last year in Chicago. But in Washington, D.C., they were up about 40%. And to be honest, it's too early to really know why that big change happened in D.C. Officials locally there are attributing it to an increase in guns and weapons trafficking, but we don't really know if that's accurate or not.
So it is a little counterintuitive to me, just as a news consumer, to think about homicide being down nationwide. If you consume the news, you're seeing mass shooting incidents like seeming to be more and more frequent. You're hearing daily news crime reporting, and it feels like we're in some kind of murderous death spiral as a society. That is what it feels like.
Mm-hmm. That's not quite where we are. Obviously, mass shootings have increased. That is unquestionable, and they've received a lot of attention, rightfully so. But they do represent overall a pretty small percentage of homicides in a given year. Nationally, the rate peaked in the 80s and the 90s. I believe 1980 was the highest on record. Locally here in Kansas City, I think 1993 saw well over 150 homicides. And so since then, nationally speaking, the homicide rate has been cut in half. So, that's objectively wonderful news on a national scale.
I've done some reading on what people think accounted for the spike of recent years that we've kind of touched on, and one of the theories is being called the Ferguson effect, but people seem to actually mean two different things when they say that. Can we discuss?
The Ferguson effect kind of refers to statements made by Sam Dotson, who is the chief of police in St. Louis, in the wake of, you know, the unrest in Ferguson and the shooting of Michael Brown. The two kind of different theories that it relates to are, one, that in the wake of the unrest, basically police departments across the country sort of disengaged a little bit and stopped being as proactive as they previously had been, and that therefore resulted in, you know, higher crime rates and fewer crimes being solved. Kind of the other theory is basically that criminals were empowered. It's more from a psychological standpoint. They just felt like they were more likely to get away with committing crimes. Now, I want to be clear, it's not known whether either of those is accurate, and you know, statisticians and criminal justice experts across the country still aren't really sure why the crime rate increased and why the homicide rate increased. It could have just been basically a statistical blip.
And we are still, though, in an elevated homicide rate compared to, like, if you take kind of a long view.
Yes, we are still above where we were before 2014.
I want to pause with Chris Haxel. He's going to stay with us, but Damon Daniel is with us from the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime. And Damon, first of all, we'll get into some of 2018 in review, but what do you think about a quote-unquote Ferguson effect?
I really don't like the term. I mean, I think when we talk about the Ferguson effect, we really need to be talking about criminal justice reform, police reform, things like that, in terms of how police are engaging the community, 21st century policing, things like that. I don't really connect the dots when we talk about homicide rates and Ferguson effect.
So looking back on 2018 and the drop in Kansas City's homicide rate by 10%, what is your perspective? Did this year look different to you as you were doing your work on the ground?
No, it didn't look different. One of the alarming things for me is always the number of youth that we lose to homicide. This year is 32%. We just look at Kansas City, Missouri, and we lost 6 kids between the ages of 0 and 16. And so for me, that is the biggest concern. I was in Liberty, Missouri, just yesterday afternoon as it related to the Northland homicide involving 2 17-year-olds. In a false drug sale ended up in the death of a 21-year-old. Again, you know, this ripple effect that it has on the community. We were there to kind of consult with the Tri-County counseling agencies and others that are coming to the aid of the school districts in the area. And some were case managers and teachers that had those students in their classes. And just dealing with that trauma associated with that particular crime and homicide as well. So, you know, for us, it's really looking at how do we impact the youth and help these youth understand, you know, I keep saying this and I sound like a broken record, but really helping our youth resolve conflict without violence, but also giving them some other avenues for being able to, you know, have fun and just offering them some other alternatives as well.
When you talk about a ripple effect, can you describe that a little bit more?
Well, so in this case, just using that example, you know, so here's a mother who has lost a son, one to incarceration and one that is deceased now. And that impacts the community in such a way where, you know, the students are now going to be going back to class after the winter break here, and there's going to be empty seats in those classrooms, empty seats at those dinner tables. And then a lot of kids who may have known those kids or knew what was going on, it's talk on social media about it as well. And the fact that, you know, a lot of teachers and parents and others aren't really all that equipped to deal with this kind of issue. And so
especially not when they're in the middle of actively grieving.
Absolutely, absolutely. And these kids show up to the classroom with all those questions, and they don't pay attention in class. They begin to develop post-traumatic stress and other things like that that impact them academically. And if our kids aren't successful academically in the classroom, then they won't be successful outside of the classroom and in the community as well. So it's going to have that long-term effect.
You're talking about 17-year-olds, and mm-hmm. just thinking back to what it's like to be that age, I'm thinking about that what you see your friends doing is such a profound influence, that seeing one of your friends headed to jail and one of your friends being killed, that says something to you about your options.
It certainly does. It sort of creates this sense of hopelessness in some, but also depression and things like that, which often leads to suicide. And things like that, too, which we don't talk a lot about, particularly with our youth. And so now's the time to really be, you know, proactive in that regard, but also looking at how do we equip our school systems to address it effectively.
So the incident that you're talking about was in Liberty. Mm-hmm. And with homicide rates determined by Metro, it does seem like when you look at even like, you know, zoom in a little closer, one neighborhood to another, the picture could vary quite a bit. Do you see this differently, this issue of homicide and homicide rates in Kansas City, depending on where you're standing within the city?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you have our East Side, or let's just say East Patrol, that still carries the lion's share of homicides across the metro. And these are communities where, you know, folks are sort of become used to hearing the gunshots and seeing the yellow tape and hearing the sirens, things like that. So it looks different everywhere we go.
Is that sort of habituation a problem in and of itself?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, that's why we go door to door and we canvass neighborhoods and try to let folks know that this is not normal, and that we offer, counseling services to those to help them understand the signs and symptoms of trauma as well, so that it's not normalized.
You know, what I'm about to bring up has been discussed a little bit already here on KCUR, but there was a notable change in Kansas City's historic Northeast. As of early December, anyway, there wasn't a single homicide in that part of town. And that's largely being attributed to a new effort to tackle the problem in a collaborative way, whereas it seems like previous efforts had been driven by lots of different groups who are kind of siloed from one another. Sergeant Robert Gibbs is with us from the Kansas City Police Department to talk about it. But I'm curious, before we turn to him, Damon, what your thoughts are about that, what happened in the Northeast and the siloed nature of the past.
Well, I give kudos to Maddie Rhodes and their ability to collaborate with others in the Northeast and really look at a holistic approach to this, and focusing on families, focusing on prevention, looking at how they provide services that are providing a skill and a trade to families, educational opportunities, things like that, but also cooperating with the police department in different ways in terms of community policing, things like that. So it's been a remarkable effort put on by them, and they have been measuring those approaches as well.
Well, Damon Daniel, hang on with me. Sergeant Robert Gibbs, as I mentioned, is with us from the Kansas City Police Department. He's the department's liaison to the No Violence Alliance. And Sergeant Gibbs, can you describe what it is that happened in the Northeast this year?
Good morning to you. When we started our enforcement activity in that area, first we went to the neighborhood leaders and we asked them, what are the problems that you're seeing? So we had a meeting with them to try to get a little bit of an understanding of what was going on there. And then we had basically an area canvas. We mapped out areas within the old Northeast, and we went door to door and we asked people at each of those homes, what are the things here in the city that are working well? What are the things that aren't working well? Can you give us any information about any criminal activity that's taken place? Are there cars that are parked in the alleys? Are there places where there's a lot of trash? Things like that. So we took all that information and we got it to the proper agencies within the city, and there were some good results there. And we also did an enforcement activity in that area where we had officers from the No Violence Alliance, our enforcement officers in that area constantly looking and working to try to eradicate the criminal activity that was taking place.
It seems like connecting the dots from like trash not being picked up enough to something like homicide, that seems like quite, it's big. That feels like a big leap on an intuitive level. Does it feel that way to you as someone who works in law enforcement?
No, because from what I can see and research, it's the broken window effect. If you walk down the street and there are lots of broken windows on that block, it gives a feel that people don't care and that the criminal element is welcome there. But when people take the time to call and report, even if it's just saying, hey, I heard some shots fired, gets us over there, and it lets the criminal element know that we can't stay in this area because people here are watching.
But if it's just a matter of we can't stay in this area, then the idea is go somewhere else. No?
If everyone does that, sooner or later, there's not going to be any place for them to go.
It's as simple as that?
I wouldn't say it's as simple as that, but that's a good first step.
So, I mean, do you see something in this that we could implement more broadly? And is there talk of that?
I think that getting to know your neighbors, going as simple as getting to know the person that lives on each side of you and in front and behind you, getting to know them so that if something is happening at your house that doesn't look right, one of your neighbors can call and say, hey, there's somebody in front of your house. They're beating on the door and I heard a bang. Is there someone supposed to be there working or something like that? I see someone carrying out some of your appliances. Are they supposed to be doing that?
How do you empower neighbors to behave that way with one another within their communities?
We can't make them, but we offer the suggestion, get to know your neighbors. Even if you don't like them, even if it's a situation that you don't get along with them, you're there on that block. Whether you're renting there or you're living there and this has been your home for 25 years, you have to work together in order to make it so that your block is not one that the criminal element will want to flourish on.
When you're talking, though, about people maybe living in a neighborhood that has been identified as like quote unquote dangerous or something like that, there may be some fear in proactively getting to know people. Do you think that people are afraid to take those first steps?
Yes, there's a lot of fear of that. But you need to try, because if you don't, the criminal element is going to come and it's going to want to stay there.
Chris Haxel, what are your thoughts about this as the Guns in America reporter here at KCUR, what you're hearing so far from our other guests?
I mean, the broken window theory of policing is not a new one. That's been around for a long time. The evidence is kind of contradictory. You know, some studies indicate it works, some indicate it doesn't. I mean, I think the key is in the implementation. You know, if you are rallying the community to take care of itself and to, you know, decide that, well, we want to fix broken windows, we want to clear graffiti, we want to clean the streets, that's one thing. If it's the police going in and arresting or citing people for these small petty crimes, then that, generally speaking, it does not work as well, because that just creates animus between the police and the community.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We will get right back to Central Standards check-in on the homicide rate in Kansas City in just a minute. We'll be bringing another guest in on this panel, and we'll get beyond the numbers with a simple question for each of our guests. That is, what doesn't get talked about enough in conversations about homicide? We'll spend the rest of the show talking about those things. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about homicide in Kansas City. As we look back on 2018 and hope for progress in 2019, we've been talking with three guests. Chris Haxel, he's KCUR's Guns in America reporter, Damon Daniel of the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, and Robert Gibbs of the Kansas City Police Department. Hi again, everyone.
Hello. Hi. Greetings.
Now I would like to turn to Rosalind Temple. She's the director of a Kansas City chapter of Mothers in Charge, a group that works with the families affected by the trauma of losing relatives to homicide. And this is an issue Rosalind, unfortunately, knows really well. She lost her own son to homicide in 2011, and she has transformed her grief into a force for good. She does everything she can to keep other people from having to go through that. Hi, Rosalind.
Hi, good morning.
It's nice to have you back. Can you talk, I know we've discussed this, but can you talk a little about the work you do and the window it gives you into Kansas City's problem with homicide?
Yes, when homicide occurs in our community, I'm called out by the murder squad of the Kansas City Police Department, the sergeant. And I go out to the scenes, be there to liaison between, be there for families, police department, and the community. To show that I do understand, because I have been through it, lost my own son, to bridge that gap and where we can be able to talk to each other, where the community and the families understand the investigation part of the police department, what they're doing.
You know, we've heard what the numbers say. Homicide was down last year, but how would you describe 2018 again, like from the ground level where you're operating?
It was just a rocky road. You know, I said 2018 was really rocky. It was, you'd be up, you know, one minute you, from my phone is constantly ringing, homicides is occurring, then it just get like, just come to a standstill. It's like people just standing on, then all of a sudden it spring out of control again, homicides start up. I just think that basically we're dealing with a community that is hurting. That is sad. The neighborhoods is so sad. Standing out there, going out there, being there when family don't even know their loved one has been murdered, hurt. And I'm standing there and seeing where in our neighborhoods where people do not even come out their homes.
Yeah, we were just talking about that. This idea that a first step could be people getting to know their neighbors better. But how do you do that when fear and sadness are engulfing you?
I agree with Sergeant Gibbs. I love that he brought that up, because when are we going to take that fear and turn it around? Because it's not stopping. We had 135 last year. The year before, 2017, 151. Today, we have 4. So it's starting right back up. We have to take that fear piece and turn that fear around and tweak it around and be afraid, because they're out here and they're still roaming our community. They're going to do it again if they hadn't already done it before. Are we going to be hurt again? So we have to get them off our streets. We have to stand up. You know, I look back and I think about my life. You know, this wasn't my life. I think about me losing my son. And the fear I had the first year when my son was murdered, my son didn't even stay with me. He lived in his own apartment where he was murdered at. And I was scared to stay in my own home to go to sleep at night for a whole year. I said to have family members come there and sit with me so I can be able to go to sleep. But I had to take the power back, because I had been violated in the worst way. So I had to stand up in my community and fight for something that was right. It's not right for someone to take someone's life. And we go on and be okay with it and be in a fear. When the fear switched around, we got to do something different with the fear.
So how can you talk to me about how you personally found it inside yourself to turn the fear around? I love the idea of it. Can you tell us how that went for you, how you did it?
Number one is God. For me, you know, it was a power greater than me that gave me strength to love me when I couldn't love myself. And so I know when my mind was renewed, renewed to get to where I was able to understand that my son was murdered, he wasn't coming back. And I've seen families before and over that have lost their children or loved one due to senseless violence in our community, and we're allowing it. So I just had to stand up. I had a power greater than me that told me stand up and take them fight. So I have a fight in me. So I just said, I would not allow that perpetrator or perpetrators, because my son's case is still unsolved, to keep taking that the strength, that authority over my life. And so I stand up and help other families that don't know how to help themselves.
So when Damon Daniel talks about trauma being an important thing to deal with as we try to, like, move forward as a city and reduce this homicide rate and reduce it and reduce it and reduce it, do you agree with that? Trauma is, it sounds like trauma is an important thing in turning this around.
Trauma is very important, but I want to tell you one thing. You don't get over it. You learn to live and heal and have a hope through it. it's not my son is not coming back. So I haven't got over his death. I just learned to do something in the place of it to help another family. And healing is for me is to go out to them scenes and stand in the gap for that family member when they don't know, or when the family member when they know they're out there, to hug them. Even when the police department is out there doing what they do to serve and protect our community, I'm there to help them to help they do their job better. We have to come together. Somewhere we have to all work this as a piece together. Sergeant Gibbs said, going to them neighborhoods. I was standing out last night on a homicide, and I told one of the mothers and mothers in charge, it was a family member of hers, and I was there. I said, look at this neighborhood. People do not come out their homes. How do you allow probably 25 officers? The street is blocked off, lights everywhere. It's no more than about 9 o'clock at night, and knowing someone is laying down there, and they have the police department and the crime scene that are covering it up, and you all do not come out your house. That's a problem.
Do you think that there's an idea that you might be in the way if you come out?
No, just come out and stand out of their loved one. That was a life. That was a human life. You know, we fight for so many other things in this country, in our community. But when are we going to start fighting together for saving lives? That it's not okay. And push these people, like, get them out of our community. You come through and you see, like Sergeant Gibbs said, windows broken, trash. That is a problem. That makes things people don't care. We can come over here and we can sell drugs. We can set up shop. We can kill people. No one's going to care. Well, we do care. We got to come together and we got to make it. We got to fight.
What else? You talked about standing in the gap. Are there other gaps that need someone to step in and do something? What gaps do you see that still need to be filled?
It's going back a generation of things in family homes. We have gaps where, like, I'm a woman. I'm just a mama. I was just a mama, simple mama. I'm just trying to be a mama to my child, my children. And we have men. We need to really come out and try to get more mentorship. We have a lot of organization programs in this community mentoring, but we got to hit the ground level to do it. We got to come together and bring – we all got unique things we do. We all, every organization, every people have something to bring to this plate. We got to bring one thing and come and put together and start talking and do, just not talk about it, let's do it.
What do numbers and statistics mean to you? Is it helpful to look at homicide rates from year to year? Is that meaningful to you?
It helps me to know them are lives. It helps me to better understand for people say, oh, it's 135 or it's 450. It helps, but these are people. We got to go back. These are human beings. They were, a lot of, like Damon said, a lot of them were young people. We're starting right back off with young people again. And a lot of those women last year, a lot of women were killed. And it just seemed to be okay. I don't know what happened. I know when I was the era I was coming up, it was a code of respect on the streets. We have lost all respect.
Can you tell me more about the code of respect that you remember?
The code of respect, I remember that even if you want to fight, have a simple fist fight, you know, you put a stick on your shoulders, or people have, they have boxing gloves, they have came to a common thing, or even if a young man wanted to be with another lady and they was, and you might even know this other man, but y'all kind of knew of each other, they would talk about it. And it was just things that just didn't happen. If you skip school in your neighborhood, and I'm telling you, coming home in your family, and the whole block know, you know, in everybody generation houses telling you're going to get in trouble. I remember the street lights coming on. Everybody had to be in the house. It was just families and neighbors. We talked. We worked together.
What do you think stands in people's way of doing that now?
I think people have a lot of cover up they're doing for themselves. I think people think that whatever, and like I just put myself, if my son was on the other hand, committed a murder, and a lot of people think that details who you are as a mama. Well, it don't. I truly believe no mother or father raised a child to be a murderer in their right mind. It's a tweak on that, in their right mind. I think we think that people are going to look at you if things happen. I think that we have to come outside and do the best that we got and to help and to stop this violence. We got to start speaking up, and it starts right in our homes. I've been saying this for years and years and years since I've been doing this. It's in our homes. It's in our homes. Until we address us, people in our homes, it's going to continue to happen.
What do you mean by it's in our homes?
It starts in our homes. It's generational stuff. You know, what goes on in my home stays in my house. Stop tattletelling to our kids and stuff. That's that no snitch mentality. Kids grow up. And it's just a lot of things that we as grown-ups, we raise our children on a generational thing, how we were raised. And we use it, but today we know it don't work. So when are we going to change it, start changing our conversation with our children? Even though my children are all grown, you're never still too grown where I can't tell you what I think or what you should do.
Sergeant Robert Gibbs, what do you think of what you're hearing from Rosalind Temple, excuse me, this right now?
She's right on point. When there's a situation, heaven forbid, a child has a gun in a home, any parent should have an idea of what their children are doing. And if you know your kids are out there doing bad, it's your responsibility. It's not the responsibility of the community. It's the responsibility of the parents to make sure that their children are not doing things that they shouldn't be doing.
Can I just play devil's advocate a little bit in that? What if those parents are financially in distress and having to spend the bulk of their attention outside the home just putting food on those children's tables?
You come home sometime. You're there. If you truly care about your children, you're there. You take the time to talk to them some. Maybe go into their rooms. Make sure that they're not doing things or have things in their rooms that they shouldn't have. In the time that I was a homicide detective, there were times that we would go and do search warrants or turn houses, and there are shotguns, there are assault rifles under mattresses. And parents would say, I didn't know that was there. We, not someone else, I am responsible for my child. I am responsible for my child.
Damon Daniel, can you jump in here? What are your thoughts about the conversation you're hearing?
Well, I think that they're spot on as well. And Rosalind's right. It does start at the home. It does start in the home in terms of morals and values and teaching the next generation those values. Particularly, you know, I talk a lot about forgiveness and how we need to be able to forgive those who are offending us in order for all of us to walk away safe. I think that they're spot on in that regard.
Can you say more about forgiveness?
Well, you know, when you lose a loved one to homicide, forgiveness is sometimes the last thing you want to do because you're so angry at what occurred. But what I try to get families to understand is that forgiveness really isn't, I mean, it is about the other person, but it's more about yourself and how you are arriving at this place or finding your pathway to healing. And that begins with just letting that sense of vengefulness go. And, you know, particularly when we talk about arguments or we talk about domestic violence, things like that, getting to a place of understanding the other person's position, whether you agree with it or not, is so important. And so we have to get to a place where we understand each other, whether we agree or disagree. But we have to begin to get to a place where we forgive the offense as well.
Rosalind Temple of Mothers in Charge, what doesn't get talked about enough in these big community-wide conversations about homicide?
I think for me, the race, you know, it's black on black. You know, we have a lot of black on black, and no one likes to talk about it. I don't have a problem talking about it. My son was a black man, and he was murdered. We have too many. And see, we you know, yes, black lives matter. They definitely do matter. But we have to make sure they matter. And when I say that, because we have to stop killing each other as black people, you know, we have to learn how to deal with conflict. Like Damon said, that's one thing, to walk, to agree, to disagree, to be able to walk away and not agree with you, but walk away and to respect you that I won't come back and kill you. Then we want to talk about mental health issues. you know, mental health, you know, then we take the street narcotics, the street drugs, and put it on a little bipolar or schizophrenic, and then you off to the races, you know, and that drug just takes you to a whole other level. We don't talk about that. Because as a black woman dealing with my mother had mental health issues. I was raised when a mother had mental health issues. And I remember my mother going to West Missouri, they called back then PRC. When she go, they put them on the Thorazine. So in our community, people seen people walk around like a zombie. So we didn't talk about mental health issues. We kept that, we bottled that up inside and we covered it up. And like I said, put some other drugs on top of it. And then there we go. And all it takes is someone to step on your toe or bump you or any misunderstanding, and you take a gun or some kind of weapon, and you kill someone. So a lot of that's not talked about in mental health issues. You know, we just cover up things.
Well, so mental health and race, I want to ask this question of each of our guests so that we can shift our focus to start talking about the issues that really do bubble up once you've scratched the surface and gotten past that surface level. So what doesn't get talked about enough in community-wide conversations about homicide in Kansas City? Damon Daniel?
Well, I think Rosalyn is absolutely right when you talk about mental health. That's certainly important. I think that, yes, substance abuse is another thing that we can talk more of. But, you know, I think that there are people who are tired of the homicides and they are speaking up. You know, we do get tips on homicides, and I think that the reward that Tips Hotline now offers up to $10,000 is also helping as well. But I don't want the community to get the impression that people are not speaking up, because they are. So I think that's another important part of this conversation. But also, you know, there's not much protection, though, for those that do come forward in terms of keeping their identity safe as well. And we've got to do something about that. I understand constitutional rights as it relates to, you know, being able to face your accuser, things like that. But we lawmakers have got to begin to look at that. I can go on and on. I know you asked me for one thing, but it's complex when you're talking about this.
No, you've got given some good places to start. Chris Haxel?
You know, a lot of the problems that we're talking about here today are problems, and they are factors which lead to violence, but they are in and of themselves symptoms of what I think is the ultimate problem, which is generational poverty. You know, one of the reasons Rosalind's talking about people who don't know their neighbors and they don't, you know, go outside of their homes. Well, if you've been evicted from homes, you know, three or four times in the last 10 years, and so have your neighbors, then how are you supposed to know each other?
Okay, so poverty. And Sergeant Robert Gibbs of the Kansas City Police Department, what don't we talk about enough when we talk about homicide?
That the citizens of Kansas City have the ability to solve 99% of the homicides that occur. Because whether it's a situation that they saw something or someone told them something, they can all be solved, or the majority of them can be solved. In 2017, our clearance rate was 58%. Last year, we moved up to 73%. The national average is somewhere around 60. But in the 1960s, the national homicide clearance rate was in the 90 percentile. We have to talk. When I was in homicide, we'd go and knock on doors, and if people didn't give information, that homicide would languish, and then there would be another one. And until someone came along with that information, because in the time that I've been on the police department, I've only witnessed a crime taking place once, and I responded to it. So it is incumbent. We can't do our job without the help of the citizens of Kansas City, Missouri.
We are talking about homicide in Kansas City. Homicide was down in 2018, but we are already counting in 2019. We're getting past the numbers, going a little deeper. Our guests are considering everything from race to mental health to this, what we can do about to empower people who are standing up. Poverty. The list goes on. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and the good news is the homicide rate in Kansas City was down last year. The bad news is we are already losing people to homicide in 2019. Our guests for today's conversation, Getting Beyond the Numbers on Homicide, have told us that to really move the conversation forward, we need to talk about race. We need to talk about mental health. We need to talk about substance abuse. We need to talk about how to empower people who do care, people who want to stand up. We have to find a way to protect people who can help. We have to address generational poverty. Just a few minor societal details. You can call 816-235-2888 to chime in, but I'm going to pick this right back up with our guests. Damon Daniel of the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, you drew our attention to people do care, and that seems like something worth trying to leverage.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think. I'm so used to just using examples. I met with a mom on Friday whose son was killed back in June, and she feels as though she's at a place where she can advocate for her son. And though she's still grieving and has not accepted the counseling services as of yet, she's still at this place where she's wanting to join forces with others. In fact, I gave her Mothers in Charge number to reach out to Roslyn as well. But people do care. And I'm thinking about this mom because she has received so many calls from people or text messages from her son's friends and things like that. And what we try to tell parents like that is to encourage people to talk to police, because the mother's going to take all this information and try to pull the pieces together herself, and is so motivated by, of course, the loss of her son, that she wants to try to solve the case, but she can't do that by herself.
Why do you think that she would rather, on some level, do it herself than turn it over to the police?
She didn't feel all that comfortable with police, which is why she came to us. And, you know, one of the things we do is set up a meeting with her and the police so that she does have that level of comfortability where she can share what she knows. But we try to encourage her to connect us with those who are giving her that information as well, so we can do the same thing. 'Cause people are reaching out. They are. They do care. It's just that level of trust isn't there yet with law enforcement, for whatever the reason is. And we can talk about that as well in terms of race, but we don't have that much time.
Yeah. Although I am curious about Sergeant Gibbs' response to that. I mean, what are your thoughts about how to make people trust more and the reasons why they don't?
Communication. It's a two-way street. Something that I would run across from time to time when I was in uniform, if I'm standing somewhere, a parent would say, "You better act right or he's going to take you to jail." And that starts that wedge. And depending on the situation or if I had time to, I would try to redirect that conversation and say, no, the person that's in this uniform, they're doing a job. And if you're in need of help, they're going to do everything that they can to help you, to try to make it so that we don't start children off as babies seeing the police department as an adversary.
There are so many stories that have gone so public that might also, though, reinforce that message.
When I'm not in a uniform, I'm just a guy walking down the street. And what motivates me is my desire, my will to want to help people. And that, by and large, is what makes many people in law enforcement do what they do. They want to help people. So, yes, there are things, there are situations that don't work out the way that they should or the way that they could, but we're here and we want to help.
You know, Damon, Rosalyn brought up race, and I know you said we could go on about that and we probably don't have time, but I would like to hear a little bit more from you on that. What do you think race has to do with addressing homicide in Kansas City?
Well, it kind of goes back to our expert here on the panel when we talk about poverty as well. I mean, what in Kansas City particularly, you know, as you look at historically the racial dividing line in Kansas City, that being truce, you will begin to really look at the historic racialized policies that were in place before desegregation occurred, and when we before you had the white flight and black flight and things like that. Well, now those same neighborhoods that were segregated are now segregated economically as well, which has had an impact on race, being that minorities are the majority of those that are living in areas where there is concentration of poverty, which has breeded a lot of the crimes that we see today, that being even homicides as well. So for me, it's definitely connected to the racialized policies surrounding economic development and things of that nature.
If you could make just magically one thing happen just on a really practical level for some of the families and neighborhoods you work with who are dealing with high levels of violent crime, what do you think, like, if they could be given just one thing to help, what would it be? You have to pick one.
I have to just sum it up as opportunities. I think people just need an opportunity to get on a pathway to success.
Let's talk to Dave in Kansas City, Kansas, who's called us. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
What do you want to share?
Well, it seems that all those little solutions are great for what pops up around here, but if you
where is here? Sorry, can you tell us where you are?
I'm from Kansas City, Kansas. And if we could just kind of back up the microscope a bit and look at the big picture of being broke all the time. Like I told the producer, I'm 54 years old. I've been living paycheck to paycheck since Reagan was president. And if we could just make a living out there, we wouldn't be so tempted, you know, to deal coke or weed, or we wouldn't be tempted to war or with, you know, neighborhood gangs and you know, just to eat, you know, just to pay bills. It's tough. I mean, it's almost impossible to collect unemployment nowadays. I'm between jobs and I'm probably going to lose my house. But, you know, they make it impossible to collect unemployment. If we could all be a little more wealthier, we wouldn't need to turn to violence and robbing liquor stores and cheating other people or getting over, or, you know what I'm saying? It's a big picture of greed.
Well,
that's Dave, really killing this country.
Thank you for this call. Damon Daniel, when you hear him talking, it sounds like part of Dave's message is about poverty. And part of it, what I hear also, is that people don't want to commit these crimes, that's not like the deep, dark, like, desire of their heart.
Well, when you have more to lose, you weigh the risk. And so I agree with him in terms of, you know, if you have access to wealth and you're doing well, particularly even financially, or if you are employed, you think twice about taking a life. You think twice about committing a crime. You think more about your choices and even the relationships that you're in as well. And so you have to weigh the risk. And I think that that's an important factor.
You know, Chris Hexel, you brought up poverty, and I'm interested in that because you are the Guns in America reporter, and I'm interested that you did not bring up guns as the thing we needed to talk about.
Well, I mean, we are in Missouri, which has some of the most liberal gun laws in the country, and that doesn't appear like it's going to be changing anytime soon. And so, you know, what I'm hearing from people, you know, since I've started working on this project is, a lot of people at the ground level at this point, they just think it's kind of beside the point. Like, we're not going to change those laws right now anyway. And there are too many guns on the street, but what can we do about it? So we may as well focus on these other issues because that's what we have, you know, an opportunity to change.
So when you hear Dave's call, is that kind of what you were getting at when you mentioned generational poverty?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, it sounded like what Dave was talking about was just a lot of stress, and everybody knows what stress is. But I mean, if you just think back to like the most stressful part of your life, or the most stressful moments in your life when you didn't have any money, and maybe you're more likely to snap at your significant other or your children. Okay, well, now take that stress and increase it tenfold and make it last for your entire life, and make everyone who lives in your neighborhood also experiencing that stress. And now you're talking about generational poverty. So, I mean, how would you react in these situations? I think that's kind of what Dave was trying to say.
Sergeant Robert Gibbs, is this something that law enforcement talks about? Like when you're talking with your colleagues about homicide, do these kinds of things come up?
When I was in a homicide unit, we didn't really dwell on why it happened. We tried our best to figure out ways to deal with the situation. Poverty is an unfortunate thing that's here in America, and education, finding ways to treat your neighbor the way that you would want to be treated.
Yeah,
there's a whole lot involved in that, and I don't think this is a conversation for it.
Well, I wish our listeners could see the way you're looking at me and shaking your head, because, it's powerful, and I will remember it. Our time is up. Thank you so much to everyone who participated in this conversation. It is a difficult topic. I really appreciate it, and we're trying to bite off a lot today. Sergeant Robert Gibbs of the Kansas City Police Department, Damon Daniel of the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, Rosalind Temple with us from Mothers in Charge, and KCUR's Chris Haxel. Thank you all.
Thank you.
This conversation will be available online later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. And if you have an answer to the question we asked, that is, what don't we talk about enough in these conversations, send us a note with your thoughts and ideas. You might inspire us. Our email is centralstandard@kcur.org. This show is produced by KCUR's Melody Rowell with Suzanne Hogan, Coy Duggar, Chris Young, and intern Felisa Kalakal. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman.